Blog Talk Radio.
Scott Golden here with the Power Perception Radio Network. Welcome, welcome to those of you who are new. Welcome back to those of you who are seasoned veterans of what we do around here. It's been a little bit since we've been here. A busy schedule coaching folks to be at their best, but we're glad to be back here. Just bring you up to speed in case you're new, because we always get new people. The Power Perception Radio Network is a project that I've been working on over the last almost 3 years, be 3 years in November, where we bring together a wide array of individuals from all walks of life, talk to them about the power of perception in pursuing their passions. A lot of P's there. Anyway, there's over 350 episodes for you to check out, so choose the ones you like, ignore the ones you don't, but support what we're doing. We want to eventually take this project onto terrestrial radio. We need your help to do that. Now, if you want to be helpful, but it doesn't cost you anything, all you have to do, follow us on social media at PO Perception on Twitter. We crossed that 50,000 follower barrier, thanks to all of you. So we're excited about that. Or you can follow my professional profile on LinkedIn at Scott Golden, Golden Opportunities Coaching. And we'd love to hear from you there. Anyway, Sean Pratt will be with us momentarily. 30 years in TV and film, 20 years in the art of recording audiobooks. We're going to talk to him about the value of the voice in all forms of entertainment. Also going to talk to him about what it takes to make it in that world and where audiobooks in general, which is my preferred method of consuming books, are going and where that trend is taking us. He's recorded over 930 titles. Good gosh, I don't know that I could record one without stumbling over my words. But in any event, we'll merge that call now. Sean, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi, Scott.
Thank you so much for taking time out of what I'm sure is a super busy schedule with all that you've got going. But to kind of give our listeners a little bit of your background so they know what we're going to talk about over the next hour or so.
Well, like you said, I started acting when I was 10 here in Oklahoma City, where I was born and raised. And I went off to college and got my BFA in acting and started working professionally by the time I was 18 and moved off to New York in my early 20s to become a classical theater actor and worked off Broadway with the Pearl Theater Company and at regional theaters around the country. But then around, 1996, I moved to Washington, D.C. and I was introduced into the world of audiobooks. I had met an actor a few years previous in Washington, D.C., while we were working on a show. And one day in the green room, he said to me, we were talking, and I said, "What do you do when you're not working?" And he said, "Well, I narrate audiobooks." And I thought that was really interesting. I wasn't really excited about doing it myself. I was working full-time as a theater actor. But I said, "Well, what is all that about?" So we sat down over a cup of coffee, and he told me. And it was intriguing. And he happened to say, "If you ever, you know, move down to this area, give me a holler and I can introduce you to some people." And sure enough, 2 years later, I did. And that was the start of it. I met a gentleman named Grover Gardner, who's a real icon in our industry and now a good friend of mine. He helped me cut a demo and get me my very first two clients, Blackstone Audiobooks and Books on Tape in Los Angeles. And I was off and running. And that was 21 years ago. And 930 some odd books. And it's only been recently, I'd say in the last 10 years, I started doing workshops on audiobooks, but in the last 5 years that I've been coaching privately one-on-one narration. My specialty in the industry is nonfiction, which is much more difficult to do than fiction. And it's also what I teach. It's my niche as a coach. And so I am very busy. I record all day, and I also teach as well, and in between other things. And but I'm very happy. I'm freelance. I work from home. I'm very satisfied with the way my career has turned out, and I can't wait to share, other information with your listeners.
I really I love audio. I've been around doing audio, be it for live streaming DVD releases or projects like this for, good gosh, I can't believe I'm going to say 21 years next year. But the advent of audiobooks has really fascinated me because lots of people don't like to, you know, sit down and read, but many will consume audio content. What has been the most fascinating part of your journey in learning that art form? Because I think it really is an art form. And what are some things that people might be surprised to know about the audiobook world?
Well, you know, when I started in 96, the rocket was just at the liftoff pad, as it were, metaphorically speaking. Up until the early 90s, audiobooks were sort of a novelty. You know, you would recorded books, the company recorded books, was sort of the war horse of the industry, and they would do unabridged audiobooks of classics that you could check out from the library on cassette, you know, and back in the day. But mainly they were used, audiobooks in the 70s and 80s were used as a marketing gimmick to help push sales of the print book. But around the early 90s, audiobook sales themselves really began to gather steam in a way that really shocked everyone. And there was a real paradigm shift because of it was growing at an exponential rate, the number of audiobooks produced. In the old days, it used to take four people to create one audiobook in a studio. You'd have the narrator, the talent, right? And then you'd have a director, you'd have an engineer, and then, of course, you'd have a producer. So four people to create one audiobook. And it was an expensive proposition when you've got four paychecks for one project. And that's okay if they're sort of, like I said, a novelty gimmick or something that is going to be sold to libraries. But because people kept demanding more format, and then with the advent of compact discs, and then, of course, 96, we're talking about the Internet, so the infancy of downloadable content, all those things sort of came together at the same time so that people could suddenly, you know, have CDs in their car, which were, you know, fewer CDs than a cassette, and then eventually, of course, they could download it right into their car or their computer or eventually their phone. And it's the accessibility, to me, that married up with people's interests. So suddenly you could download that book you wanted to listen to onto your phone or your laptop and take that with you no matter where you were out without having stuff that's cumbersome like cassettes or CDs. And when you put those two pieces together and the fact that more publishers became more savvy about the profit potential of them, all that sort of combined so that the number of audiobooks that get produced grows at an exponential curve from around 95, 96 to the present day. It's been an amazing journey. Every year there's more and more audio content being created, and the demand is just growing, whether it's podcasts like yours or e-learning. And then, of course, we have the standards. We have fiction and nonfiction. But they're all out there, and there's a huge potential. It's mainly about educating the public that audiobooks are just – you can get the same value, if not more value, out of listening to a book than it is to read because, like you said, people are busy. So instead of being stuck, you know, on the beltway, as it were, listening to music or something or feeling like you're wasting time sitting at the airport, now you can listen to something that entertains you or educates you or both.
I've got to think one of the challenges in that industry would be pacing and cadence. No?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. There's as far as this, the skill of doing it, people with a performance background, right out of the chute, do better as narrators. And that's not to say you don't get someone who comes along who's just a natural storyteller. But yeah, the nuance of storytelling, it's so much more important because you're just working with that microphone. There's no audience feedback. The microphone picks up every subtlety. And then, of course, you have, you know, fiction and nonfiction are two different sort of beasts, as it were. And within each genre, there's subgenres, you know, whether it's fantasy or thrillers or romance or whatever in fiction. And then in nonfiction, of course, you have memoir and self-help and business. But there are definite challenges to each one that require, you know, like I said, performers tend to do better That said, there's plenty of anecdotes about people who come from a theater or film background who've never worked on a book, who've been hired because they're a celebrity, as it were, to come in to narrate a book and have a very shocking experience when they realize just how difficult it is to narrate a book. The vocal and mental stamina required is considerable. I always refer to narrating an audiobook as eating an elephant. That old joke, you know, how do you eat an elephant one forkful at a time? But there are, yeah, there's differences. Would you like me to talk about the differences between fiction and nonfiction as far as performance?
We'll get there in 1 second, but
sure,
I want to follow up with a question that pops into my brain, which is when I read something, and it's why I was never good at acting, but very good at improv. When I read something, I have a tendency to put words in there that are not on the page. And I'm thinking that, you know, even if it's an and or a but or whatever, I would think that would be a major challenge in audiobook recording as well, because the mind is working faster than the mouth. And so tripping over things would be a big challenge, at least in my thought. Am I off on that?
No, you're absolutely right. But first of all, if you put words in or leave words out, that's why all the material gets proofed after the initial recording, and you get a list of fixes to come back. And, you know, you might get the corrections sheet from the proofer. They would say, well, you said what, and that the word is that, or you mispronounced this word, or so on. And so it goes through several levels of quality control before it's released. And it's a skill. You learn to be strict with yourself and read what's on the paper. And but that's just a skill. That's just technique. And you are right. The mind moves at a pretty fast tempo. It's like what I teach my students, especially in nonfiction, is the analogy I draw is for people who read music and play instruments. If you learn how to read music really well and you play your instrument really well, when you're reading the music, you actually start to get a little bit ahead of your own playing. Your mind is working that fast. Your eyes are taking in the information so fast that you open up a tiny gap of time before you would play the note or, in our world, say the word. And in that little gap of time is when the acting decisions get made, or to verify that the word is how you think it should be pronounced and so on. And we're talking, you know, a split second, but that split second makes all the difference. And so it's a skill. It's just, you know, it's just a matter of practice. It's that old, like Malcolm Gladwell talks about in his book, about the 10,000-hour rule. You know, it's just something you learn in the moment of doing it hour after hour after hour.
So I would think, too, that an interest in the subject matter one is reading about, or at least an openness to it, would impact on the final project or the final draft, as it were. Is that on base, or can a good...
Well, yes and no. I think that's sort of the hallmark. I think that's the difference between being an amateur and being a professional in any craft. There's that old, I don't know who said it, I want to say it was like Humphrey Bogart or someone said that a professional is somebody who can show up to work on a day they don't want to be there, to work on a job they don't really like, and still do a great job. And I think that's one of those distinguishing characteristics about the difference between a professional and an amateur in any career. You know, I've narrated plenty of books that were poorly written, or the ideas weren't well thought. But you would never know it from my performance. I mean, I'm not paid to editorialize in my performance. I'm paid to deliver the best performance possible. That's why people hire me. And ironically, sometimes for the better narrators, you do get books that may not be well written, but the publisher knows this book is going to sell, so we need to put lipstick on the pig, as it were. And so sometimes you get books that aren't very good, and your job is to turn them into something really entertaining. So it's a real challenge. It really does. It's as challenging in its own way as when you get a really wonderful, excellent, amazing project to work on that you're enthusiastic about. You have to pull out all the stops, use all your bags of tricks, and really focus on the material to turn it into something special.
Have you ever had that moment yourself where you looked at it and go, I don't know if I can pull this off, and then it comes out better than you expected?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, like I said, in nonfiction, it's a pretty wide field. And I've been tasked with with books that on the surface I'm like, there's challenges, and in a way when you come off of something and you say, yeah, that was a good read. I figured out the puzzle of how do you record an audiobook version of a cookbook? How do you record an audiobook version of a sociology book with all these self-assessments and charts that need to be described? How do you come across as the voice of that author in a very odd or let's say it's a very aggressive kind of marketing book, you know, like buy my coaching program and make $1 million on Wall Street? How do you make that entertaining? So at the end of the project, you reflect on it and go, if you do it well, if you come out of it and go, yeah, I took something that was a puzzle without any guide or any instructions and figured out a way to make that entertaining, because I tell my students that the ultimate measure of whether an audiobook works or not is, was it entertaining to listen to? That's the ultimate yardstick. And if it's not, then you haven't done your job.
Now, you mentioned there's major differences between fiction and nonfiction. What are the most notable of those differences?
Well, very quickly, in the world of fiction, since an audiobook must be entertaining, when you think about fiction, a piece of written fiction, its purpose is to be entertaining. So the connection, the process you go through to make that piece of fiction entertaining is a little bit easier. I don't want to let your listeners think that doing fiction is easy. It's not. You have dialogue and accents and the narrative voice and tempo, and it's tricky. It can be very, very difficult at times. But that being said, when you go over to nonfiction, you hit these four big obstacles that can really, really throw a wrench in your day for a new narrator or even an author who wants to narrate their own material. The first obstacle they hit is that you have to repurpose the book, because the purpose of a piece of written fiction is to be educational or informative. But so you have to repurpose the book to be entertaining first, so the listener will stick around to hear the information. Because if it's not entertaining, they'll either turn it off or it will literally go in one ear and out the other. The second obstacle you encounter are people misunderstand. They think that nonfiction equals non-acting. You know, you're just reading facts and figures or just, you know, information about how to invest in Wall Street or, you know, a book on sociology or whatever. But the truth is there is acting involved. It's very basic, but it's there. The third obstacle they hit is that they have fewer storytelling tools to work with. We don't have funny voices or romantic scenes or car chases in nonfiction. You just have the author's voice giving you their intellectual argument in a logical progression to reveal their truth. And so you better know how to use those few storytelling tools you have. But then the last obstacle, and this trips up everybody, even seasoned narrators, is one of stamina. Unlike in fiction, like let's say you're doing a murder mystery, you know, you as you start reading it, like that, let's like the new Dan Brown book that's out right now. You know, it starts from a place of zero, of tension, and the first couple chapters build at the first point. Then there's a chapter that, of release, and then it rises over a few more chapters to a higher point of tension, and then a chapter of release. So it's got this sort of jagged, you know, mountaintop kind of graph till you get to the ultimate moment in the book. But in nonfiction, after the author gives you their idea and sets the tone and tempo of the book in the preface and the foreword, it's relentless. It never stops with that progression. You know, you're never going to be doing a book on Wall Street investing and then suddenly have a chapter about cupcakes and bunnies in the middle of that, you know, that is a relaxing moment. It's relentless in its drive. And so in the end of the day, it's just exhausting to maintain that level of mental focus and vocal performance on nonfiction. So those four things really highlight to me the difference between fiction and nonfiction.
Now, is it commonplace if you have a main, let's say two main characters, or a romance sort of fictional work, to have two voice actors narrating, a female doing the female part, a male doing the male, or is it generally one person doing all of the above?
Well, it's generally one person. because it's more expensive, frankly. I mean, if you want to look at the economic model for companies like Tantor Media or Blackstone or HarperCollins or whatever in their audio divisions, what they're really doing is they're sort of like buying they're buying a CD or a certificate of, they're buying an investment. They're investing in that product, and all the money is, all the expense is front loaded. And so it's sort of like Hollywood also, you know, it's like Hollywood invests in a lot of movies knowing that they're only going to have a handful that'll make a ton of money to pay off all the other ones that either break even or don't. And so when a book gets produced, you know, if it's a Dan Brown novel, the return on the investment is going to be immediate. But if it's a lesser title, a B-list or a C-list title, it's, you know, all the money's up front. So it takes time for that book to sell for them to reap a profit on it. And so it makes more sense to have one performer do all the voices, because that's one, you know, if you have two or more, it just costs more money. Now, that being said, there are plenty of now multicast versions of books out there. And every so often an author will ask that it's a dual narration. So those do exist, but they're really, they might constitute barely a couple of percent of the thousands of audiobooks that get produced each year.
You mentioned coaching folks who are getting into that industry. I know that in broadcasting, there's bad habits that need to be broken. Habits one doesn't even know that they may have. What are some habits that people have to break in order to be good at audiobook narration?
It depends on their background. So let's take broadcasting. I have a number of students who have a broadcasting background. So in any kind of voiceover, whether it's broadcasting, video games, radio, television spots, and so on, there's a certain style for that venue. You know, there's a certain performance style that's become sort of the stock and trade of, you know, if you're going to be doing video games, it has a certain delivery style. If you're going to be doing broadcasting, is it, NPR kind of broadcasting, or is it sports broadcasting? And there's a certain, like I said, a certain delivery style. And that the listener has grown accustomed to, and that person, the announcer, has learned on the job. So the thing that has to happen is they have to, I don't want to say unlearn it. I just think you can't really unlearn anything. You just add to your skill set. What I tell my students who come from a broadcast background is that I use the example of playing the guitar. So I said, okay, so all this time you've been playing rock and roll guitar. Now we're going to take the same skills so you can use the same notes, but now we're going to learn how to play Spanish guitar. So the same basic principles apply. We're just using it in a different way, in a different venue, for a different style. So in nonfiction, the goal, the industry, the catchphrase in the industry is they want a conversational read, as if you're talking to someone or a group of people. And it has to sound like that person, that particular narrator, really talking, like you and I are talking back and forth, but it's the text that they're working from. So they have to learn a different kind of cadence, a different kind of melody, as it were, a rhythm, a tempo to the delivery, so it sounds more and more like them talking to the person or group on the other end who's going to be listening to the piece.
Suppose we have a little fun now. If you could narrate any work or book, all time, just for personal enjoyment, do you have that kind of holy grail piece that would be like, I'd really like to tackle this just to see if I could do it?
It's just going to seem a little cliched, but I would love to do Moby Dick. It's my favorite book. It's extremely challenging. There's all sorts of nuance to it. That's in the world of fiction. In nonfiction, oh, goodness. I don't really have a particular book in mind. I have particular genres in mind. More historical fiction, nonfiction, you know, like a history of the Civil War, like Shelby Foote's, you know, catalog on his multi-volume description of the history of the Civil War. Something like that would be something I would go for. this may sound a little odd. People ask me often, what do I read for enjoyment, for entertainment, and I tell them that I don't, because I narrate a book a week. I'm constantly reading ahead and prepping the next book I'm about to do. So I don't actually have a lot of time to read for enjoyment, to find a piece, go, oh, I'd love to read, to narrate that. It's more about in nonfiction, when I come across a book on Amazon, it's about the topic that intrigues me. So I don't really have something out there that's been, you know, taunting me, other than Moby Dick, frankly.
How much prep work goes into the process of being ready and able to record an audiobook?
Book is its own little beast, of course. Some books I have a little method that I use and that I teach my students about doing basic prep on the book, as far as researching who the author is, who do you think the audience is, what the genre is, and then also sort of because now, you see, to pick up the thread of what I told you a few minutes ago, in the old days there were four people producing an audiobook. Well, for all intents and purposes, that paradigm has gone. Now, every so often in New York or LA, they will have those four people involved on a project, but that's become the exception in the industry. The majority of audiobooks are now produced at home by one person, the narrator, who has to wear all four hats at once. So you have to learn to be, as part of your prep, to master all four of those hats. And so as the director, which is sort of what you're talking about as far as prepping a book, you need to read the book, of course, and decide how do you say this phrase in Latin? How do you say this chemical formula? How do you say the Prime Minister of Hungary's name? Those kinds of basic pronunciations are critical. If you're reading fiction, of course, you have to read the entire piece, especially if it's a mystery, so you know that the mysterious voice in chapter 4 was so-and-so in chapter 12. And so depending on the book, you could spend, several hours or dozens and dozens of hours. Earlier this year, I was contacted by a publisher to do a book called The Doctrine and Ritual of High Magic by Eliphas Levy. It was written in 1855. It's French. It was a new translation. And it's about the dark arts, about the tarot and paganism and so on, from 1855. And when I got the text and I, when I was going through it, looking at it, I realized immediately there was no way I would have time to do the level of research involved, because there was easily a dozen different languages involved in the book. There were charts and graphs and illustrations. And so I hired a researcher to do that for me. He ended up generating an Excel spreadsheet that ran to over 120 pages of phonetic pronunciations and audio clips for me to listen to, so that when I went in to record it, I had all that information at my fingertips. And now the other flip side of that is sometimes I'll get a book on, how to be the best coach you can possibly be, by Gus Johnson, 15 steps to being, the number one coach in your field. And you just look at it and there's no research, other than knowing the author and a general idea of the genre, because it's all told in first person. He's putting down his big intellectual idea, and it's very straightforward. It's written for the laity, and so there's very little research in that. So every book varies between one of those two extremes.
And I've got to imagine one of the frustrations would be with an author. We all know that whomever is the author of the day wrote
right.
the book. But in audiobooks, it's kind of like at the beginning of the book, narrated by XYZ, and then you almost slip back into an anonymous mode, no? So how does a good audiobook narrator get recognition, get the value of that, and build a name for themselves?
Well, yes, I mean your goal, of course, is not to outshine the material. You're not, they should. Your goal is to disappear into the book and become the author's voice. That said, of course, every narrator has a unique voice and style. That's inescapable. We're not trying to mimic the literal voice of the author in nonfiction. we're trying to capture their ideas that are on the paper, and you know, but each narrator has a distinctive style and voice, and then what happens is that particular narrator's voice and presentation can garner a following. People just, you know, there are some narrators, you know, I know for a fact there are some narrators who have fans that would listen to that narrator read the phone book just because of the quality of their voice and the skill with which they narrate. And of course, we have industry magazines and blogs and things that review our work and publish reviews about the quality of our work, and that helps, you know, people who are enthusiasts of audiobooks. They read those magazines and blogs, and they start to follow certain narrators because of the quality of their read. And then, of course, there's the Audible.com review section for listeners to chime in. But over time, you build a work history, just like anything else. You know, over time, narrators build a work history, both with the publishers and with the fans, and they come to expect a certain thing, a certain end result, a certain kind of performance from that narrator. So you do build up a reputation over time, but it does take time.
Suppose we have a listener out there who is contemplating breaking into that industry. What are some things they can do to be prepared in order to kind of open that door for themselves?
Well, the first thing I would tell people is that it's not a matter of talent, it's a matter of temperament. Do you have the temperament to sit in a little tiny box hour after hour by yourself to stay focused on the material? Do you have the temperament to direct yourself? Do you have the temperament to learn the software? There's a lot going on when you're working by yourself at home. So I created a little video on my YouTube channel called So You Want to Be an Audiobook Narrator, and in it there's a test, and I'll give you the short version of what that is. Basically, I get emails quite literally every day from people around the world who are interested in audiobooks, and I say, go watch the video, take the test, and if you pass it, you'll know. So the test, in sort of the short version, is pick a book you like in whatever genre you like, and then set up a small space on a table, chair, get a book stand or a music stand to put the book itself on that stand, because you're not allowed to touch the material because it would make noise, you know. So you're looking page after page. Shine a light on it, and try to find a confined space, like a closet. Or, you know, or if you don't have something, some small space, face into the corner of a room. Turn the lights off, shine the light on the material, and then proceed to read out loud on more or less for 2 or 3 hours a day for 2 weeks straight. I mean, take some breaks in between. And don't just mumble your way through it. Pretend like you are actually narrating this to an audience. So if you stumble over a phrase, stop, back up, and start the sentence again. If you hit a word you don't know how to pronounce, stop and go look it up. You're not allowed to guess. And do that for 2 to 3 hours a day for 14 days. And that will tell you quicker than anything else whether or not you have the temperament to do this. I get follow-up emails from people all the time who've watched the video on YouTube. And they say, Sean, I watched your video, and it's absolutely positively convinced me that I will never want to do this for a living ever because it's not anything like I thought it was going to be. It's a lot more difficult than people think it is.
Suppose that you have a person who tries it, mm-hmm. and then either they're told your voice isn't right or your timing cadence isn't right or something like that. Are those things easily corrected, or does it take a certain
direction? Sure, I think so. I mean, if you're willing to spend the time and focus to do it, I mean, there's a huge misnomer about people who narrate audiobooks from the public. You know, I can't tell you the number of conversations. I'll be at the airport or traveling or someone, and they'll say, so what do you do for a living? And I say, well, I narrate audiobooks. And they sort of give me a quizzical look like, that's a thing? You know, aren't you just reading the words out loud? And of course, they've never really thought about the level of skill it takes to do it and do it really well. So when when I get contacted by people, I say, do the test first just to see if you have the temperament. And if you pass the test, yes, then, you know, then you can start to, you know, get some coaching with people, listen to other audiobooks, and start to learn. You know, I was an autodidact. I came from the theater, but I'd never narrated anything until I started. And I listened to audiobooks incessantly to pick up, you know, tricks about, like you said, cadence and delivery. And as far as the quality of the voice, unless the person has some voice and diction issues, in other words, if they have, let's say, like a whistling S, or a maybe they're a heavy breather, or they have a very, very thick accent, those things need to be addressed separately. Those are voice and diction issues. You would see a vocal coach for those things. But as far as the performance, everybody starts out, you know, feeling their way. There are no, you know, no one, there's very few naturals out there. And so, yes, if you're willing to spend the time, you can overcome those things. It's no different than learning, you know, how to play piano. You just have to spend the time and the energy and the focus to really push yourself to get better over time. And so, yeah, absolutely, you can overcome that.
You mentioned the recording aspect and the software. Is that a really complex process, or can a moderately technologically intelligent person learn how to do that pretty proficiently?
Yes, they can. Excuse me. You know, there's lots of recording software out there. You can, you know, Audacity is free. So is Studio One, which is a great piece of software. It's what I use to record on. And what I recommend for people who actually want to learn how to do these things is, on Facebook, for every piece of recording software out there, there's a Facebook group devoted to it. So go join that group and start asking questions. Or do what I did, which was I hired someone to teach me how to use the Studio One software and set it all up for me. It was the best $100 I ever spent. I just wrote a check to the gentleman, and we set it up, you know, via Skype. He showed me how to do it, and I was off and running. I used to work with Pro Tools, which is a very complex piece of software, but I transitioned over to Studio One. It's much simpler. And you're right. It is. You know, the thing is ultimately we're not recording Sgt. Pepper's here. We're just recording the human voice without any effects whatsoever. It's a dry recording, as we would say. It's sonically dry. And then you can learn how to take all those little edits for chapter 6 or whatever, make one big file, and then there's a certain number of steps involved in compressing and equalizing that so it sounds, it's up to industry standard. But those are just, that's just clicking buttons, and you can be taught how to do that. So yes, I mean, I don't pretend to know anything, hardly anything on the technical end. I just hired people to teach me, and then I, you know, I just follow the instructions, and you do it every day, and then it becomes second nature.
Individuals who are interested in getting into that line of work, are you paid by the project or are you paid by the hour?
Very good question. The major platform where new narrators go to look for work is a place called ACX.com. It stands for Audio Creative Exchange. It was created by Audible.com, which is owned by Amazon. So ultimately, ACX is owned by Amazon. And it acts as a place to bring authors together, first-time authors, self-published authors, and so on, and voiceover narration talent. And people, you know, they create a profile and they start auditioning for what's up there. That's one place. That's not the only place to find work, but I'll use them as an example. Basically, for remuneration, it can boil down into just a handful of ways to get paid. The first is what's called a royalty share, where you do a book for the author for free up front. You do all the work free, and ACX acts as the honest broker between you and the author. So you do the work, and then the book gets published, and then every time it's downloaded, you get 20% of that fee. The author gets 20%, and of course Amazon gets 60% because they own everything. The other version is what's known as a hybrid deal, where you get royalty share plus a small stipend per finished hour. And that's a really critical thing to understand. We don't get paid by the working hour. If the let's So let's say I have a stipend of $50 a finished hour, and it's a 10-hour book. That means I'm, no matter how long it takes me to do it, I'm only going to get a check along with the royalty share money of $500. The last version, which is the version I work under, is called just a straight per finished hour rate. And so I have my rate that I quote a client. So let's just say for the ease of math, it's $200 a finished hour. So if it's a 10-hour book, it's $2,000 for that project. But the onus is on me to be as succinct and streamlined as possible when I am narrating and doing the work. So if it takes me, I mean, just do the math. If it were to take me 10 hours of work to create 1 hour of finished audio, then I'm only making, what, $20 an hour in the end. So it's about learning to do, there's editing tricks you learn. Sometimes you farm out certain parts of the work itself, like proofing or mastering. Someone where I'm at in my career, I don't ever do the proofing or mastering on my own because I work for the major publishers. They take care of all that, and I just get paid my fee. But in the end, you get paid by the finished hour. And it's a crucial difference between getting paid by the, you know, as opposed to being paid by the working hour.
Is there a good formula for, let's say I'm listening to a 3-hour audiobook, about mm-hmm. how much record and edit time would a seasoned to moderate professional need to complete such a project? Is it like 2 hours for every recorded hour, or does that vary as well?
Well, okay, so let's just, we'll ballpark here. First of all, there's a method of recording known as punch and roll editing. That's what I teach my students, and it's really the only way to fly, in my opinion, if you're going to be a home-based studio narrator. Think of it this way. Let's go back to the days of tape, okay, way back when. So if we were recording something on tape, you would be recording the voice until you made a mistake. Then they'd stop the tape and rewind it a few 5 or 6 seconds. Then they'd hit play, and then just before the mistake, you would hit the record button and record. You would punch into the recording and then roll over the mistake with the new recording and keep going. So it's an additive process. So by the time you're done with chapter 6, it's ready to be proofed. So that's a very efficient way of recording, as opposed to recording the whole thing live and going back later and cutting and pasting the performance, you know, little take by little take, which takes forever. So using punch and roll recording, a seasoned narrator can record in 2 hours of work, 1 hour of audio. Now, that's just the recording part. Then it has to go through a proofing process, and that's also done by the finished hour. So the proofer, that can vary, because if a proofer is listening to a seasoned narrator who's done their homework, there's very few times they have to stop to notate a mistake. But if it's a narrator who didn't do their homework or is not very good, they have to stop again and again to write those notes down. So a one-hour piece of audio might take several hours to proof because of the level of mistakes, the number. And then, of course, the last step would be after they do the fixes and drop the corrections in, it has to be mastered. And when it's mastered, it's done in real time to be compressed and equalized as an MP3 file. So when you put all those little steps together to create what you hear when you download a book from, say, Blackstone Audio, for every 1 hour of audio, you're probably dealing with, I'm going to say, anywhere from 5 to 6 hours of work to create that one piece of audio from different people.
Wow.
Or from
one
narrator.
That's heavy. That's a lot of time.
Yeah, well, it has to be done. You know, what happens if you don't proof it and it gets out there and then suddenly, you know, the street in the city in Texas is called Houston, but the street in Manhattan is called Houston, and you better know the difference, you know. And if you don't proof it, it has to be proofed in real time. And then the actual mastering is, like I said, you highlight the track and you hit go and you step away, but that still counts as time spent on that track.
Now, I know for me, I can love a show that I've done, and listening back to it, not something I do. I don't like hearing my own work. Are you the same way personally, or are there certain works that you have done and performed where you're like, okay, I can go back and listen to this with a non-critical ear and enjoy it?
Very rarely. I would rather take a beating than listen to my own voice. Because I narrate 4 to 6 hours a day, and I teach on top of that. So I'm constantly talking. I'm either recording into the microphone or on Skype talking with my students. And so I'm constantly speaking. And so the notion of listening to myself is just anathema to me. But that being said, every so often, I will come across a book that I'm really proud of the work, and I want to go back and listen and critique myself. So, for instance, about 10 years ago, I guess, I did a book called Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. It was the most difficult audiobook I've ever worked on. It was this brilliant piece of postmodernist fiction, wonderful, wonderful, challenging book. And I've actually listened to that book twice. It's 57 hours long. And that one's worth going back for. Recently, I did a nonfiction title, which I would suggest, I would recommend to your listeners. The content was so good. It was called The Death of Expertise by Tom Nichols, an amazing book about sort of the epidemic of the death of expertise or experts in our society, in American society, because of things like education and the internet and how those are having a negative effect in politics and social interaction. Really compelling, really good text, very well written. And so I want to go back and go, I wanted to hear that. And I listened to it. And I was very pleased with my performance and the content itself. So on a rare occasion, I will find a book I do want to go back and listen to. But the notion of spending any extra time listening to me speak is not one of my favorite things.
You mentioned several times working with students. Why don't you use a few minutes to give an overview of what you can help an aspiring audio narrator to accomplish and how they can contact you in order to do so?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think we'd step back, and for any student, they should know what kind of coach they're approaching. Coaching usually boils down into one of two categories. Either it's tactical or it's strategic. Let me give you an example of tactical coaching, at least in my world. When I was a theater actor in New York, I had an acting coach, and so she was a tactical coach. You would schedule an hour with her, and you'd go to her apartment there in Chelsea, and you'd bring in a monologue from an audition or a play you're working on or whatever, and you give her a copy, and you get up, and you start doing it, and she directs you. She crafts the performance in real time, back and forth. You're performing. That's tactical coaching. It doesn't require a lot of preparation on the coach's part other than their, you know, decades of work history, so they know what the heck they're talking about. Strategic coaching is more like taking a series of classes over time, like a college class, and that's the kind of coach I am. I have a curriculum where I meet my students once a month, and there's a progression. I have a textbook that I work from, and I teach them not only technique as far as, and I specialize only in nonfiction. If they want a fiction coach, there are plenty of those out there, but I focus on nonfiction exclusively. I'm one of the few coaches that does that in the nonfiction world. And like I said, there's a curriculum. Every time we meet, there's a new lesson with a new idea. There's new material for them to go off and narrate. And I teach them about the business part of show business as well, the methodology of what we do. There's so many people I've known over the years who've left show business, not because they weren't talented enough. It was just because they didn't have the temperament or the drive to learn the business part. So I force my students to learn that, you know, using social media to advertise and find clients and talk about their work, to build marketing and advertising materials, build a good website, get good demos. So like I said, there's structure for the performance that they go away and they record and they send it in and I listen to it. And there's methodology, like I said. And then the last thing I try to teach them as a coach, and this is over time, that's why it's months. I mean, if the student commits to me, we're going to see each other once a month for easily a year. It's that thing about, really, it's confidence. You know, they're entering into a new venue, even if they are a seasoned professional as a performer. And no one's really taught them how to wear that director's hat or what kind of nuance is required. And it's a very, you know, it's very off-putting. It's, you don't know what you don't even know. I just got lucky back in the day when I first started narrating that as a brand new narrator for my clients, I realized very quickly that I needed to keep recording every day to learn how to do this. So I would call up my clients and tell them, I'll narrate anything nobody else wants. I don't care what it is. And they took me up on it. I did some really, you know, B or C or D list titles, but that was okay. I learned from doing. And in the act of that, I gained my own confidence as a narrator. So yeah, I mean, as a strategic coach, what I provide is structure and methodology and, in the end, confidence for my students. You know, they can find me, if they want to reach out to me, they could find me on Facebook at Sean Pratt Presents or on Twitter at SP Presents. My website's undergoing a remodel right now, so it's down. But I'm easily findable on the web. You can look up my name, and there's plenty of contact. You know, my email address is seanpratt@comcast.net, and they can shoot me an email and find out. I'll send them information to find out more, you know, about the nuances of what I do as a coach.
And I think one of the things that you mentioned there that I think is super valuable is the competence to know yourself as a performer and to understand that rejection, unfortunately, is part of that. You may not be the ideal fit for every bit of work that comes across your pathway. No?
No actor, no performer can do everything. That's impossible. You know, that's one of the first things I disabuse them of. This notion that, you know, when you talk to a performer, like, oh, I can do it all. No, you can't. Sorry, you can't. Other people can do it better than you in certain aspects, in this case, in audiobooks, in certain genres. You've been listening to my voice for a while now, so, you know, my voice is not really well suited to, say, hard-boiled detective fiction, like noir fiction. It just doesn't, it's not a good fit. Nor is it good for young adults material, right? So you learn to pick the genres that fit your voice, and then you go after those genres. You try to audition for those materials. And yes, of course, you know, it's never personal. I mean, like I said, they say you have to have a thick skin to do this. And yeah, to a certain extent you do, but it's more of a paradigm. You just have to understand that when you get turned down for a gig after you audition for it, it's not that they decided, oh, well, let's have Sean audition just so we can ruin his day and not give him the job. They don't know me well enough to do that. If you know what I'm saying, it's, as they say in The Godfather, it's just business. You know, you weren't the right fit. There was somebody who fit that, the criteria they came up with, just a little bit better, and they got the job. Now, you can, if you really want to know, you can wait till that book comes out and then listen to it and figure out why did that person get the book and you didn't. But yeah, it's never personal. Sometimes I joke that I should start my own, you know, as a lay psychiatrist for my students, because I have to deal with them dealing with that. They hit a patch where they can't, you know, they audition for job after job after job and nothing happens, and it rattles their confidence. So then we work on, well, let's make your auditions better. What do we think might be lacking here? We attack from that angle, as opposed to, you know, them buying into this wrong-headed notion that somehow it's personal, that they don't have the talent, or they don't have, or that people hate them as a performer. That's just not the case.
And I think a lot of it too is knowing your strengths and playing to those. We all have strengths.
Absolutely.
We all have weaknesses. And if you can cover your weaknesses but accentuate your strengths, you're on to something.
Yeah, you know, there's a, I narrated a book recently talking about just this issue. They've done studies where the book was in the context of training salesmen to be better salesmen. And they cited several studies where if a person has, as a salesman, let's say, using from the book, the salesman has 10 different little jobs that they're supposed to do from the moment they, you know, find a prospect to the moment, to the very end when they close the deal, right? There's like 10 little jobs. And most salesmen only are good at a certain number of them. There's almost no salesman that's good at all of them. And so you have a choice. You can send that, if you're a manager of that salesperson, you can send them off to school to try to be better at the stuff they're weak at, or send them to school to become even better at the things they're already good at, and then hire someone to fill in the gaps for them. So they're only focusing on their strengths. You know, now granted, that takes time. It takes working with someone who can assess all that stuff. But yeah, absolutely. You know, I learned long ago that I wasn't going to be doing a lot of, you know, detective hard-boiled fiction, but I do a lot of self-help. I do a lot of, you know, empowering, upbeat, hey, you can do this kind of business books and sociology books, or given my background in classical theater, I can handle really difficult text very well. So I focus on that. You know, that's where my natural talents lay as a narrator. So, and there's plenty of work in those worlds. Does it mean I can do everything? No, I can't. But I can do those very, very well.
Become really good at what you know you can do well, and you won't have to worry about what you're not good at. You can leave that for somebody else.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. We've got about 4 minutes remaining. We've covered so much ground, but is there anything you feel we haven't covered that we can in the last few minutes here?
Well, as far as I would advise your listeners, if they are serious about wanting to give this a shot, take the test. I'm all about cheap and free. Take the test. The test only costs you your time. And if you pass the test, then download some free software, get yourself a little USB microphone, and start playing around with narrating every day. Right? Take it a stage at a time. Don't go out and spend thousands of dollars on high-end equipment and a expensive whisper room or whatever, and elaborate classes and coaching. Take it a step at a time and see if you really want to go down this path. And then if you do, if you keep moving forward, then the next logical step will be taking webinars or watching YouTube videos on narration, and then maybe looking for a coach to work with in the particular genres you want to work. And they're all out there if you look around. But please do your due diligence. Know the background of that coach. Know how they coach. They should be willing to sit down and talk with you about that. And have fun with it. You know, I have plenty of people that I've coached who had no performance background, who just wanted to do this. They really liked storytelling. They loved reading. And they were willing to work hard to learn this new, you know, very particular craft of performance. And they've done very well. I'm very proud of them. I think of my students as my kids. I've got two of my own, but I have, you know, plenty of students out there that I get thrilled when I see that they've landed a book or won an award. But it is doable. It's not impossible.
All right. And one more time to the pay window as far as contact information for you, for anyone who may be interested in doing so.
Sure. On Facebook, you can find me at Sean Pratt Presents. On Twitter, it's SP Presents. And if you'd want to send me an email directly, it's my name, SEANPRATT, at Comcast.net. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you have and send you information if you want that. And if I can't help you, I will try to steer you off into some place or someone who can. I always try to go the extra mile for that. I will answer the emails when they come. I make a point of that.
All right. And I thank you so much, Sean, for your time today. If you are new around here, there are 360 now, plus episodes in the archive. And we like when folks go back into the archive. That's, believe it or not, archive is where we do the majority of our listens. So we know that everyone has busy schedules. You can put it into your iPad, your iPod, your listening device and listen on the go at your convenience. I encourage you to follow us on social media at PO Perception on Twitter, Scott Golden, Golden Opportunities Coaching on LinkedIn. And I remind you, keep your feet on the ground, your mind in the moment. Until next time, everybody.